Here we go. It's another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We have a terrific panel of journalists to talk to us today. And we have so much to cover. There's no way in the world we're going to get to all of the news of the day. But this panel will certainly help us with that effort. Before I introduce everybody, just let me give you the latest on the figures that the Department of Public Health in Georgia is has sent out. This is as of last night. We are now at 1,328 deaths in Georgia. That includes 33 deaths that were reported in the last 24 hours. My caveat there is it doesn't mean those people necessarily died in the last 24 hours, but may have died previously to that, and the numbers have just been reported. There's now 5,791 people in the state hospitalized. That's up 123 admissions in the last 24 hours. But the most significant figure about hospitalizations and the most distressing, and one that we've talked about on the show in the past, is fully 80% of those hospitalized in Georgia are African Americans. This disease continues to take a disproportionate and discouraging to hear toll on African Americans. And now we're learning Hispanics are suffering either from the disease itself or in the loss of jobs. A report just came out of Washington saying that some 40%+ of Hispanics say they've lost their jobs as a result of shutdowns due to the coronavirus. So it's awful to have to say that minorities are paying a higher price than many of the rest of us as we deal with the coronavirus. I do want to bring in the panel, and then I want to share with you a report that Willoughby Mariano of the AJC did, and I'm going to get the panel to react to it because I think Willoughby has given us, from my point of view, the clearest understanding of how they think about the virus spreading or not spreading. So let's start by getting the panel involved in this. Kevin Riley is with us. It's Thursday. The editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution joins us on Thursdays. Kevin, I thanked you yesterday, but now that I've got you here, thank you for hosting the show the other day. You were terrific.
Oh, well, thanks, Bill. You know, I'm no Bill Nygut. We all know that, but I enjoyed it. We had a great show, and I'm glad to be with you again here on Thursday morning, twice in 1 week. It's almost more Bill Nygut than I can handle.
Yeah. Tia Mitchell is also with us. She's the AJC's Washington correspondent. Tia, thank you for being with us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You filed a couple of stories in the last few days that we're going to talk about today, and we'll get to those in a couple of minutes. Adam Van Brimmer is with us from Savannah. He's the editorial page editor of the Savannah Morning News. Adam, thank you. At some point in the show, we want to hear what's going on in Savannah with the virus. But in the meantime, thanks for being here.
No, thanks for the invite, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
And Kyle Hayes, who I consider to be Mr. Peachpod. He operates one of the finest, he produces, hosts one of the finest podcasts about Georgia politics that you can listen to, even though Kyle, an Atlanta guy, is now living in Washington. Kyle, you stay on top of Georgia news so well, and your podcast reflects that. As I introduce you, I think your newest podcast is really an interesting one. You talked to the people behind the National Democratic Training Committee, they're the academy in which they're training people to be able to go out and usually go out and canvass. And you talk to them, I think, about how they're readjusting to reaching out and getting their message out in the middle of the pandemic. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that was a really great conversation. Thanks for sharing it, Bill. It was really interesting because people got out of this training committee and joined campaigns in Georgia amidst this transition away from in-person campaigning to campaigning primarily digitally. And so if you're interested in how campaigns are navigating that challenge, this is a great opportunity to hear about that.
We just heard on the NPR newscast that Joe Biden is making a visit to Florida today, a key state, obviously, in the presidential election, but he's doing it virtually. He'll be doing it, I assume, from the basement of his house, as he's been doing all of his other appearances. It'll be fascinating to see how that ended up developing. All right. As I said, I thought I've expressed my concern over a period of weeks about how we report and get from the Department of Public Health numbers about how the virus is either spreading or not spreading. The projections that have come from organizations like the University of Washington and others, some people have had taken issue with. But listen to how Willoughby Mariano in the AJC reported on this. There is a consortium of university researchers, Columbia University being the lead on this. Georgia Tech is involved in this as well. And here's how Willoughby described what they're saying about how the virus does or does not spread. She said that the spread of the disease can be determined by what epidemiologists call the reproduction number, or the R. They call it the R factor. During shelter in place in Georgia, the R factor sank to 1, which means that for each person who contracted the virus, they spread it to just one other person. And they suggested that because of that, sheltering in place at least didn't have an explosive, we didn't see an explosion of cases beyond that. But if R goes even slightly above one, the results can be exponential. The disease can overrun a healthcare system over the course of several months. So here again, if the R number remains at 1, it won't go away. We'll continue to see it. If it dips below 1, the number of new cases will be, that means that the number of new cases are shrinking and the disease can be stopped. Kevin Riley, she's one of your staffers. I thought hearing about that was a fascinating way to look at what sheltering in place has meant and how you calculate what it means if we start mingling socially and in work situations again.
Bill, you're absolutely right. I mean, experts have been worried about the virus from the beginning because of its ability to spread so quickly. In other words, how many people, even one person, could infect, right? And the goal has always been to get that number below 1 to try to get the disease under control. The real question is simple. I mean, if for states and other organizations that have implemented strict shelter in place, the idea is like, don't let people have the chance to spread the disease. I think Governor Brian Kemp's belief is, well, if people follow good rules, they wear face masks, they keep appropriate distance, we can keep this number low, and we're counting on people doing that. It really is a debate about whether or not people will do that, and so far the numbers appear to show that it's very hard to keep that number low without pretty demanding restrictions in a state or in a community.
Adam, you want to jump in?
Yeah, Bill, what's been incredibly frustrating to a lot of our readers down here that we've heard from is the numbers that are being presented. There's a lot of people that we're not getting the proper trend line on the numbers. We're not getting any kind of idea on that spread. We're not getting any kind of idea on how many people have been hospitalized and been released. We're not even really getting firm numbers on tests and confirmed cases. So there's a lot of people that are like, okay, well, I hear anecdotally that most of the cases here in Chatham County are tied to nursing homes. Well, we're only hearing that anecdotally. So people are wondering, well, should I go out? Should I not go out? And, you know, even though you've got reopened economy, you've got reopened businesses, there's a lot of people that are playing it safe and playing it cautious and not going out. And it's really, and I'd be interested to hear, Kevin, what you guys are seeing in Atlanta as to how transparent the numbers are and how hard is it to interpret.
Tia, go ahead, jump in, and then we'll get Kevin back.
I just want to say, I think, you know, you guys are talking about the difference that happens when things are mandated versus optional slash, you know, make good choices, which seems to be kind of where Governor Kemp is steering Georgians. It's like, we're going to ease the restrictions and bank on our residents to make good choices. And you see the pictures, when I look at the pictures from Atlanta, and how people are outside, and you see relatively few people wearing masks, because it's optional. And I just want to tell you guys, I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, up here in the D.C. area. And when I go to the store, everyone has on a mask. And the difference is, because it's required, you are not allowed to go into any business establishment that's currently open, very few of which are open, without a mask.
Well, I think that, you know, what this presents is confusion. I mean, to get to right to Adam's question is, I think you could walk up to 10 people in Metro Atlanta, as long as you stayed at least 6 feet away, and ask them what they believe they should be doing and whether they're following good practices, and there's a good chance you get 10 different answers. And then also the Department of Health has changed pretty routinely how they're reporting the statistics and exactly how they're compiling them. So that makes it confusing. We hear from readers, I heard from several already this morning, who are very frustrated about how the statistics are being presented. And we're working on trying to find a way to sort through all of that. But again, we're only talking about statewide statistics. You know, the Department of Health has changed that. And look, if no matter who you are, what you care about is where you live and what's going on. It's not helpful to know what's going on in Metro Atlanta when you live in Savannah or you live in Valdosta, and the statewide numbers aren't all that useful to you. So I think the state has just been exposed for having weak public health infrastructure that's both historical and ongoing, and hopefully this pandemic will inspire the state's leaders to fund that stuff and to support that stuff, because I believe, you know, and many people believe, these are the sorts of health threats that are going to be ongoing in Georgia.
Well, and the other thing that reproduction rate figure suggests, Bill, is that when the reproduction rate increases again, it is advisable for the state to then snap back to shelter-in-place conditions, restrict people's movements even further. And there has been so much frustration and political animosity related to the initial shelter-in-place order and then bringing it back to the limited opening circumstances that exist now, that it seems really questionable to me whether or not the state would see that number rise and put shelter-in-place conditions back into place. But that's what public health experts suggest you need to do based on that figure. It's going to be a really interesting problem to see how the state reacts to that figure.
Yeah, I think everybody is holding their breaths, both elected officials like Brian Kemp and Kathleen Toomey, his public health commissioner, and all of us as citizens, in addition to our work in journalism, to see what happens in the week, say, in the next 2 weeks, in terms of whether or not we have an increase in COVID cases or not based on the new rules.
Bill, the other thing that's happening, I think, and will continue to happen, is companies, especially large companies, have little choice but to try to seek out information from the best experts they have access to and make decisions about what they're going to do. Because really, when Governor Kemp talks about this, what does he talk about? He talks about small businesses. There's all this controversy about, you know, salons and massage therapists and tattoos and bowling alleys. And those things are very important. Those are small businesses, and those are his voters. But if you're a large company, you have maybe thousands of employees who are hearing different things and for which you have no choice but to try to set a policy. And it may be very much at odds with what their neighbors are doing or what they believe employees are hearing from the governor and others. So I think we have just made this ripe for such confusion in Georgia that ultimately will be very frustrating and at worst very dangerous for citizens in the state.
Yeah. Yes, it's interesting that we've learned within the last 24 hours that some of Georgia's bigger employers, the Coca-Cola company, UPS, and others have said they're in no hurry to stop teleworking to get their people back into Georgia. Tia, I want to turn to you on a different aspect of what's happening. We've heard over and over again that a governor, the president, has to balance the economic devastation brought by the virus against the dangers it poses to its citizens. This report that we saw yesterday from the state revenue department, that we had $1 billion less in tax revenue 35% drop in tax revenue tells you just what an awful situation we face economically. And as you know, Tia, state leaders here, including budget leaders in the House, David Ralston and others, have urged Congress to please take as a next step in their bailout plans, getting money back to the states, to cities who are going to need it urgently. But Leader McConnell seems to continue to be a little dubious about whether that's the next right step. What can you tell us now that the Senate's back in session up there, which is worth talking about too? What can you tell us about whether we're going to see any action up there?
Well, I think that so Republicans in general, but particularly on the Senate side, because they're in control over there, you know, there are two lines of thinking. On one side, Republicans want to bail out their home states. Every state is, you know, in a similar situation in Georgia. So, of course, there is that call from local leaders as well as, you know, their representatives in Congress. We need to help the states. However, we also know Republicans have been saying for years the deficit is out of control and we don't need to keep sending money to states and they need to better, you know, control their own destinies. And so some members are having a hard time reconciling these two very conflicting ways of thinking, even within the Republican Party. And so for the Senate, that makes it very hard for them to figure out a direction to go. Last time, as a result, with the previous CARES Act, that's why you saw a lot of it was House Democrats who are in control going straight to the White House, you know, and working it out then. And so I wonder if that's going to happen again this time. I don't see, you know, there will be another coronavirus stimulus bill eventually. It'll probably take 2 to 4 weeks, maybe even longer than that. And there will be, I believe, there will likely be some help for states. But that can come in many different ways. And that's the question is, it may not just be blank checks to the state. It might be in, you know, kind of similar to what happened with the New Deal, where there were programs put in place to stimulate the economy. It could be that type of thing with infrastructure and things.
Yeah, and I think at this point, it is really vital for listeners to understand that a fiscal crisis in state and local governments is only going to lengthen the damage, or lengthen the recession, increase the damage caused by the recession, and that's going to result in suffering for some of our state's most vulnerable residents. If there isn't additional federal aid or if there's not adequate federal aid, then the state is going to have to lay off teachers and first responders and other state employees. Those people who are laid off won't be spending at local businesses that are already reeling because of the coronavirus pandemic. So the state fiscal picture here is really important as it relates to the overall health of the economy, and the state really needs to press for additional federal aid.
You know, Adam, one of the things that has been somewhat disturbing in all of this is that certainly the president, and for that matter, to some extent, Mitch McConnell, have talked about the states in red and blue terms. And essentially, the president has made it clear he doesn't want to bail out the blue states led by Democratic governors because they're misusing the money they already have. We don't expect that the president's going to be one of the great uniters of all of us in a crisis, even in this crisis. But it certainly doesn't help to turn this into a partisan battle, Adam.
No, and it really, quite frankly, it's very sad, and it's becoming pervasive in Washington that everything is partisan. They don't necessarily, it doesn't seem to be the mindset in Washington anymore that you are elected and you represent all of your constituents and not just the ones who line up with you ideologically. And I don't know when that's going to change. I thought it was pretty interesting. I heard an interview last week with Gretchen Whitmer from the governor of Michigan, and how unsettled she was when the protests happened and President Trump did the Liberate Michigan and really kind of injected partisanship into that. And she flat out said that she went out of her way not to criticize the president, to not throw any stones, to not make it partisan, because she was afraid that if she did that, that it would hurt them getting the federal aid that they were probably asked for and entitled to just over partisanship. And that's really frightening. And, you know, you wonder how deep it's going to be. You talk about state budgets, you talk about local budgets. The city of Savannah budget here at the height of the shutdown was losing $150,000 every day in terms of tax revenue, and then another $350,000 a week in parking revenue because they had separate funds for that. And every government is going to have a huge deficit coming out of this thing, and it's going to be a slow build back. And unlike the federal government, we can't pass budgets that aren't balanced. We have to have revenue to cover the expenses, and it's really kind of frightening to think about that going forward.
Well, we know that the Appropriations Committee is meeting virtually today. Zoom gets another workout to begin looking at how they're going to fund state government for the 2021 fiscal year. Mary Margaret Oliver, a member of the Appropriations Committee on the show yesterday, expressed her concerns, and of course, particularly about what it means for health care, Medicaid in the state. So we're going to keep track of that in the days ahead. And as I mentioned yesterday, and I'll mention it throughout the shows coming up, we're really glad that Appropriations Chairman Terry England has said he wants to do the show with us next Tuesday. We'll keep telling you that, and I think it'll be interesting to hear what he thinks about how they're going to move forward. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way right now. When we come back, Kelly Loeffler is right smack dab in the middle of the news again, and we need to talk about what the latest concerns are among the people who are worried about Loeffler and the way in which her Senate job and her private sector job all kind of feel like they've conflicted. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back. Kevin Hayes, Adam Van Brimmer, Kevin Riley join me for Political Rewind today, as does Tia Mitchell, the Washington correspondent for the AJC. Tia, you filed a story in the AJC about the latest controversy over Loeffler's job and her service in the Senate. And I think your lead gives us a good starting point. You say in it, U.S. Senator Kelly Loeffler often says she gave up a lucrative career to serve as Governor Brian Kemp's appointee in Washington. On the way out the door, however, her company gave her a huge payday. We know that Loeffler, once she was sworn in up there, became the richest member of the United States Senate. Explain what the latest controversy is all about.
No, we have been studying Kelly Loeffler's financial disclosure, which she filed late last week, and it shows the money she's made. But the New York Times took that financial disclosure, looked at SEC filings from Intercontinental Exchange, which is the company that her husband founded, and that's the company that Loeffler worked for up until she joined the Senate. And what the New York Times found was that part of the reason why Loeffler had such a big payday from Intercontinental Exchange is that they changed the rules to allow her to cash in on stock options even though she was resigning before she was fully vested, you know. And I think the reason why it, you know, first of all, Loeffler is, you know, by virtue of being in the U.S. Senate, she's a target. You know, she's on the big leagues when it comes to politics. So, of course, there are going to be critics. Democrats are going to criticize her. She also in election mode, so she's got opponents like Doug Collins who are going to criticize her. So they pounce whenever they see an in. The in particularly that they perceived with this is that the rules were changed to help her make money. And, you know, that just plays into the narrative that, you know, the rich get to play by different rules and that this company that's owned by her husband, which is, you know, it's a stock exchange. It owns the New York Stock Exchange. It has federal oversight that they were trying to make sure they had her leaving on a good note when she headed to Washington.
Kyle, without getting into the weeds on this story, the simple fact of the matter, which Tia reports and the New York Times reported first, is that she was able to get a compensation package that allowed her to cash in on stock options, even though she had resigned from the company and taken her seat in the Senate before the original vestment date of those financial instruments. And as a result of the company changing the rules to allow her to walk away with all of that, she got a $9 million payday. Now, Tia points out very clearly, New York Times points out, this is not a violation. This isn't illegal. It may not even be a violation of Senate rules. But Kyle, as Kelly Loeffler tries to establish herself as as the best candidate for this job in the November election, these kinds of stories take her further and further away from the voters of the state who are right now, many of whom are struggling with trying to make enough money to survive.
Yeah, and we all remember that Governor Kemp introduced Kelly Loeffler in talking about her humble beginnings on a farm. I think it was in Iowa, but she was a person who's strong in her faith. And that, you know, these stories really take away from that definition of herself that Kelly Loeffler was trying to create for herself. And it really stands in stark contrast to people living in the suburbs who Kelly Loeffler was supposed to appeal to, who even before this crisis had even more trouble affording childcare and health care and sending their kids to college, things like that. You know, people in the suburbs are not getting million-dollar paydays when they leave their jobs. And so I think that this is a challenge for her to connect to that demographic that she was supposed to connect with. She has a challenge on her right with Doug Collins, and Democrats are activated on these issues as well. And so she is going to be taking fire from a lot of directions on these issues.
You know, so, Kevin, I want to let you get in on this.
Yeah, on Tuesday, we talked a little bit about some of her latest television ads as well. And I think, you know, all these things coming together have created a really, you know, revealed a very poor sense of timing on her part. I think the debate about billionaires and all that stuff and millionaires in our country is divisive, but I mean, I don't think anyone deep down is against someone who's been very, very successful, especially if they come from humble beginnings. It's a very simple problem, which is what Kyle, I think, was pointing out. No one knows Kelly Loeffler when you get right down to it. I mean, Brian Kemp took a big chance by picking someone who was an unknown. And now, if you walked up to an average Georgian and said, "What do you know about Kelly Loeffler?" I don't think they're the kinds of that Georgian would recite the kinds of things that would sound like, well, she's really someone I can identify with because of how this has played out. And now, will that damage her or not? I mean, you know, as we've said before, and I know I've made the point on the show before, I mean, she's obviously a political novice, and then she's going to be running against Doug Collins, who is an experienced politician, had an unbelievable platform all through the Trump impeachment, and is a guy who is a good campaigner. So I think she's in real trouble no matter what you think of her and no matter what she represents and no matter how you feel about her. I think she's put herself in a very tough spot and just sort of destroyed the advantage of incumbency that she had.
Tia, I want to get you in, and then Adam, I want you to respond too. We have another layer to add to all of this. Kevin Riley, of course, just pointed out that Doug Collins refused when the governor did not appoint him to the seat to stand down. He said, "I'm going after that Senate seat no matter what's happening with Kelly Loeffler," and he's got momentum. And the latest example of that is that this morning, the campaign of Karen Handel, running, of course, for her old seat back up there in the 6th Congressional District, endorsed Doug Collins. So if you're going to start seeing more members of the Georgia Republican Congressional delegation come out in favor of Loeffler, it just makes her job harder and harder to you.
Yeah, and, you know, CQ Roll Call recently, you know, revised its list of the most vulnerable senators, and she's in the top 10 of the most at risk of not being elected in November. And I think it was interesting, you know, if anyone on the ballot in Georgia would be most similar to Kelly Loeffler, it would be Karen Handel. You know what I mean? Like, they're both running, you know, as conservative women, but, you know, needing swing voters because Karen Handel's in a swing district. Kelly Loeffler has to win statewide. And so and Karen Handel, you know, she does have a primary, but not really serious challengers. She didn't need Doug Collins really in the primary. Right. And so I think it was interesting that she decided to align with him because it's not really helping her out. It seems to be something that she's decided she really believes in. But I also think she's decided that she'd rather have Doug Collins on the ballot in November to help Republicans than she thinks Kelly Loeffler will help her in November.
Yeah, Adam, this is really splitting Georgia Republicans apart. You've got the Kemp people who are sticking by and mainstream. I'm even not sure I can use the word mainstream, but you've got Kemp Republicans who are sticking with Loeffler because they want to support the governor. You've got the national Republican organizations trying to get behind Loeffler, but the conservative right in this state, the grassroots Republicans, don't want anything to do with her.
Yeah, and I'm so fascinated by the unforced errors here. I mean, you would think that the vetting would have been a little bit more thorough, that she, her campaign, or her people would have had a little bit more foresight into realizing that if anything sniffs of impropriety, even sniffs of impropriety, whether it's her stock transactions that were supposedly made at arm's length a couple of months back, or this whole deal of the early payout on investment, you would think that somebody would have looked at that and kind of said, you got to think about how that's going to play. And it's not just Loeffler. I think we're probably going to talk at some point here that our own representative here, our Congressman Buddy Carter, has kind of gotten snarled in a similar thing where it might not be illegal, it might not be unethical, it might just be just happenstance that something went down the way it went down, but it's the way it's perceived. And if you're the Republican Party and Republicans in the state, which I think quite frankly have started to be divisive going back to the 2018 and the Cagle-Kemp split, it's just going to split it all the more. And with Trump and Kemp dueling and going back and forth and Trump supporting Kemp at one minute and criticizing him the next and supporting him again, it really has fractured and I'm quite frankly I think confused the more ideological conservatives in this state, and it's going to be real interesting how it plays between now and November.
The one card that Senator Loeffler still has up her sleeve is an endorsement from the president, if that was to come for her. You know, listeners may remember that the president sort of floated Doug Collins for the director of national intelligence job. Collins turned that down. That sort of suggested that maybe the president backed Loeffler, but, you know, Collins led in a recent poll, and the president might not want to align himself with somebody who is viewed as unpopular by Republicans. But a lot of these issues, I think, could be overridden if Trump endorses Kelly Loeffler. And so in that vein, it was interesting to see that Kelly Loeffler, when she released some of this information, she tied herself to the president by saying that the media and her detractors had been critical of her in the same way that they had been critical of the president. She's clearly, I think, speaking to him in some of her moves here.
And one of the things I've observed in covering her is that she really doesn't have many allies. You know what I mean? People willing to, you know, not just give the tepid, I like Kelly Loeffler. She's a true conservative. That's one thing. And that's something that, you know, President Trump will say and Mitch McConnell will say. But to give a full-throated endorsement of her, to say, hey, she's done nothing wrong and leave her alone. You're not hearing Republicans go to bat for her. And that's something you can tell she wishes she had. And it's becoming very glaring that Republicans at this juncture are kind of keeping her at an arm's length.
So I've got to get to a break in a minute, but Kevin, before I do, one other aspect of this story that I've been puzzled by. Kelly Loeffler and her husband, Jeff Sprecher, who, as Tia points out, among other things, own the New York Stock Exchange, are not hurting for money. They are both lovely people, by the way. I know you've dealt with them. I've dealt with them. Just as people in the community, they've been terrific. But Kevin, I can't help but wonder, given how rich she and her husband are, given how much money Jeff Sprecher himself has, why it was necessary to give her a $9 million payout as she went over to the Senate. It's not as if they're going to have trouble putting food on the table in the months ahead. And so it just seemed like an unnecessary thing to do at that moment in time.
Yeah, you know, you are right, Bill. Jeff is very highly thought of in the Atlanta business community, and by all accounts, is a very solid guy who has built a very successful business. And so I think it's important to remember that, and I believe that probably had a lot to do with Kim's decision. I don't know. I mean, the only thing I can figure out is, again, something we've talked about. Kelly Loeffler did not spend her life preparing to pursue high political office. So that was something. What happened was probably somewhat sudden. And often, I just think this is true. Often people whose wealth on paper is massive, someone like Jeff Sprecher, I mean, much of that can be tied up in the company and working within the company, even though on paper it looks differently. So there could be all kinds of explanations. I'm not a good enough financial expert for it. But in the end, I do think it comes down to political inexperience in the way that a lot of, people who spent their life in politics would say, do this, but don't do that. And they may have just simply lacked the kind of advice that's crucial in a moment like that.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way. And then when we come back, I really want to devote the rest of our time together to talking about this awful story out of Brunswick. A shooting death that has now captured national attention, has become part of the political dialogue in the country, and is just an extraordinarily tragic event in the state of Georgia. We'll do that after this break. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Adam, since this took place down in your part of the state, I'm going to give you the first chance to talk a little about this. But we know that there is now enormous concern about a shooting that took place in the Brunswick suburbs. Ahmaud Arbery, 25-year-old African-American, was presumably jogging in a suburban neighborhood when two white men came out and confronted him, believing him to be, they thought, a burglar who had been active in the area. And a confrontation unfolded, and Arbery was shot to death. The accelerant, that happened, we should point out, on February 23rd. It's now May 7th. And we're only now beginning to understand what happened down there. We're only now beginning to hear about this story in the last days. And the video, which I personally, I cannot watch. I think from a journalistic point of view, it's important to, but watching this confrontation is very, very difficult. But it's now accelerated this case, which for weeks and weeks languished without authorities down there moving forward to investigate or take this to a grand jury. Okay, Adam, it's yours.
This story has got so many strings coming out of it to pull on. It's incredible. But the bottom line for me is, according to the family's attorney, and of course you have to take that and for what it's worth, the police have had video footage of this incident since the day it happened. And this video footage contradicts completely the statements that were in the police report about what happened. So if the police, and you like to assume then that the district attorney, have had these two conflicting things, and you've got video footage, which I think trumps testimony from somebody who's involved in the incident, why is it taking this long? And then the other part of that is that the two, that one of the men that was involved in the shooting used to work for the police department and used to work in the DA's office. So you look at that and it's just, it makes your eyes go wide as to what in the world is going on down there and what are they doing. And it's very encouraging that the GBI is getting involved. And it'll be interesting once we start to see the timeline, because that's the other thing. The witness took this video footage. They turned it into the police, and they haven't said anything since February the 23rd. There's just a lot that we don't know here. But what we do know, it should spur action and should spur swift action, at least in my mind.
Tia, one of the most heart-wrenching quotes that I've heard about this case comes from Darshan Kendrick, who's a leader of Democrats in the state legislature, African-American. And she said, and this is her quote, "Just one day before I leave this earth, I want to go an entire day not worried about my brothers or dad or neighbors being hunted in the street like animals." We don't know precisely what happened, but we do understand the emotion surrounding this, Tia.
Yes. You know, I've had a lot of friends who are Black men who run, you know, for exercise or for relaxation, and they're talking about how it impacts them to see video of a man who was running and was killed as a result. And let's be clear, one of the things that disturbs Black people that disturbs Black people on a personal level, but that disturbs a lot of people, is that it took graphic video of a man's death for people to believe that perhaps something was wrong. You know, the words in his family and of grieving mother and in weird circumstances, because the man was accused of a burglary, which is a nonviolent crime. He died as a result. Even if you believe the narrative, there was no movement until people had to, with their own eyes, watch him die. And what does that say about how America in law enforcement considers the lives of Black people?
Tia makes a good point. And let's keep in mind a couple crazy twists and turns in this thing, and also what the future holds, because I think the future is going to be just as difficult as the past has been. First of all, this went on for nearly 80 days before anybody got interested in it. And as Tia points out, and the video prompted that, we've had two district attorneys recuse themselves from the case. So it's been caught up in a sort of a bureaucratic morass that has extended it. And now, don't forget, the Georgia legal system is more or less shut down. The grand jury that is supposed to look at this is not going to be looking at it for, I think it's over a month from now. So there is a lot of time, and I think that time will, you know, again, invite all sorts of controversy and confusion and all this. And then, you know, this video, we have a story today that makes clear the person whoever provided this video was a friend of the guys who pursued the man who died. So this is...
Yeah,
this
he was apparently really, recording the chase.
Right. I mean, it's a very weird, troubling thing. And, you know, all my experience has taught me, like, boy, you really have to hope that, A, law enforcement handles this well, and that people are provided the information and details of what happened in a timely way before this just spins completely, completely out of control.
Kyle, again, we don't know the exact circumstances here. We do know the shooting took place, and it will be investigated finally, apparently. But as an investigation takes place, this once again highlights the fact that Georgia is one of only, four states that do not have a hate crimes law. The effort to prosecute, if they were to go to that far, added circumstances, doesn't exist in the state of Georgia.
Yeah, and I've seen, you know, sort of arguments on both sides of the issue with the hate crime statute. Specifically, you know, I think there is evidence that suggests that a hate crime statute does send a message that a legal system in a society does not tolerate acts driven by racial hatred or animosity towards specific groups or people with specific characteristics. You know, on the other hand, a hate crime statute doesn't necessarily speak to the delays in getting this case in front of a grand jury, potentially having charges filed in this case and other issues related to prosecutorial discretion. And it's also not shown that lengthening prison sentences necessarily has a deterrent on crimes being committed in the first place. So I think that there's a healthy debate there to be had around that issue specifically and how it relates to this case. But I think just on a personal level, you know, a few years ago, I was training for long races. I was out for runs every day the same way that Ahmaud was. And that is something that never crossed my mind that this could happen to me. And it would never happen to me because I'm white. And so I hope that people who are not as directly impacted think about how differently the experience of African Americans is in everyday activity, like going out and getting a run in, and how that experience can be deadly.
Yeah, Kevin, Elena Parent, Senator, State Senator Elena Parent is quoted as saying, if I was out for a jog, would I have any chance of being chased and gunned down? The answer is no. And of course, Senator Parent is white.
Yeah, I think that another thing worth pointing out here, Bill, is that, again, this is down in Glynn County, and we, you know, highlighted a case there a couple of years ago. A Caroline Small, you know, was the name of a woman who was officers pursued her in a low speed chase. She apparently had mental problems, and then killed her. In a way that was very disturbing. And so this jurisdiction of Georgia has some troubling history that, again, I think is all part of how people are feeling about this current case.
All right, we're going to keep track of this case. I promise you that Political Rewind will do its best to stay on top of it. I do want to point out, before we take one last quick subject here, that the Attorney General, Chris Carr, has said that after seeing the video, he's deeply disturbed by what he's seen. That's a good sign. Governor Kemp has said he wants the investigation to proceed. So maybe weeks and weeks and weeks after this shooting, we're finally going to begin to see some action in determining exactly what led to this young man's death. Very quickly, also, before we have to leave, Adam, you mentioned Buddy Carter, and I don't want to leave our listeners without an understanding of what happened. Your paper reported this first. Buddy Carter, of course, has been the leading proponent of a spaceport down along the Georgia coast there. But very quickly, because we don't have a lot of time, tell us what the controversy has been around that.
I'll try to be as brief as possible, but Spaceport Camden is located in Camden County, which is the county just north of the Florida line, so between Brunswick and Florida, and they want to build a spaceport on a former industrial site, and it's been very controversial environmentally because of the path of the rockets and the chance that it could fall on certain areas. It's been a very controversial initiative, and Carter has rallied behind it, and we came to find out that Carter had bought property nearby, about seven miles away on another coastal island. Now, he bought the property 2 years after he initially voiced support for the spaceport. And so it's one of those things that his office is very adamant of. We bought this as a hunting and fishing property where there's no impropriety here. But then when you look at the fact that he's carried the torch for the property, and you know he represents the district. If he believes in the property and sees it as economic development driver, then he should be the one to carry it. But needless to say, all of that has kind of contributed to a need for public scrutiny. It doesn't help that he bought the property for half what the previous owner had paid it for, and that the property, which is he bought for $2 million, he's paying a ridiculously low property tax assessment on it. So That's it in a nutshell.
Tia, real quick, you got about 30 seconds because you've looked at this too.
Yeah, I looked at it, and I credit the morning news with moving forward with, you know, at least giving it some sunshine and some transparency. That always helps no matter what. Of course, Representative Carter says he's done nothing wrong, but the question I still have is how he lives in Pooler. Yes, that's his district, but it's not near where he lives. So it's like, how did you find this property?
Yeah. All right. I'm sorry to cut this short. I said at the start of the show we have more than we could possibly cover and that we had a great panel to do it. I would love to keep talking with all of you for the next hour, but GPB Radio isn't going to let me do that. So let me just say thank you to Tia Mitchell, Adam Van Brimmer, Kyle Hayes, and Kevin Riley. Great conversation today. Thanks, all of you, for listening. We'll be back again with another Political Rewind tomorrow. By the way, Governor Kemp is scheduled later this afternoon to give an update on what's happening with coronavirus in Georgia. GPB Radio and our platforms, websites, and other platforms will carry it live when it happens. Take care, everybody.